Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Global markets have been a nervous mess for the start of 2016, wild and down, and there are strange signs. Rock-bottom oil, negative interest rates. Economist Mohamed El-Aryan says we're headed toward the end of the economy as we know it now. Central banks pulled us out of financial crisis 8 years ago, but they can't sustain their role as rescue leaders in the global economy, he says. It's time for governments, politicians to step in, step up, and take the reins, make new policy. Can they do it? This hour on Point, Mohamed El-Aryan on fears of a new collapse and what it will take to avoid it. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How's your economic confidence level? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from the studios of KUCI in Irvine, California, is Mohamed El-Aryan, Chief Economic Advisor, Strategist to the insurance giant Allianz, former CEO of PIMCO, one of the world's largest bond trading firms, Chair of President Obama's Global Development Council. His new book is The Only Game in Town, Central Banks, Instability, and Avoiding the Next Collapse. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mohamed El-Aryan, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
There's been a lot of talk and action, I guess, in the first months of this year, weeks. A lot of talk about a global collapse. Is it lining up with your warning, or is it on some different basis?
I think what we're starting to see, Tom, is the system giving us signals that the underlying contradictions and tensions are becoming quite large. And the result of that is a whole list of things that at one point were improbable that have become reality.
Like what?
Negative interest rates, this concept that you lend your money and then you pay interest for the privilege of lending your money. We've had so far 30 straight days in which the Dow has moved by more than 200 points intraday. We've had European central banks and Japan go even more negative on the policy rates. You spoke about oil. Who would have thought that oil would trade as low as $26? And low oil prices have gone from being viewed as a blessing to being viewed as a curse. And the list goes on. So I think the system is trying to tell us something, and we need to listen, because the road we're on right now is probably going to end within the next few years.
I want to step back and look at that big picture, but would you just help us for a moment with negative interest rates? Normally, you lend money to somebody, and they pay you a little bit or a lot, depending on what era we're in, for that money. Right now, there are governments who are essentially charging to take your money. Who's doing that and why?
So European governments and the Japanese, European central banks and the Japanese central bank have taken their policy rates into negative territory. What that does, then it pushes market rates into negative territory. So we have this very strange situation, Tom, where about 30% of global government debt trading around the world, 30% is now at negative rates. Now, why is that the case? When a central bank wants to promote economic growth, there isn't much it can do. But what it can do is try to encourage you and me and others to take more risk. So it takes down the safe rate where we would invest and can sleep well. It pushes us to take more risk where in the equity market. As we take more risk in the equity market, we push up stock prices. And the hope that central banks have is that as stock prices go up, we open a 401k, we find ourselves better off, it triggers what the economist calls the wealth effect. We feel wealthier and therefore we spend more. So we consume more and then companies see us consume more and they invest more. That's the theory. That's why banks push interest rates so negative in order to try to get an economic reaction. The reality has been quite different. We haven't gotten much growth, and now we're getting the unintended consequences and the collateral damage of negative rates.
And stock markets already high, even before negative rates, because how central banks, the key focus of your new book, The Only Game in Town, because they flooded the world with so much money since the near collapse.
Correct. And it's important to stress, not out of choice, but out of necessity. Central banks have the advantage of being politically autonomous. They do not need to go to the parliaments, to Congress, every time they want to do something. They can raise interest rates, they can lower interest rates, they can use their balance sheets. That's their decision. And it's a good thing that they have that autonomy. So starting in 2010 here and 2013 in Europe, central banks realized that political dysfunction had paralyzed other policymaking entities. So they thought they would step in and buy time for the system. Now, they didn't really like doing that because their tools were imperfect, but they felt they had a moral obligations. What they didn't realize, in fact, what very few people realize, mm-hmm. is that they would be in this very unusual situation for such a long time.
We're going to dig in and look at what the central banks have done, the limits of their power, what's needed from elsewhere at this point, from essentially politicians. But can you explain, it's just 2 months since Janet Yellen came forward and said, look, we are going to start raising rates again. Now, the U.S. hasn't gone negative, but can the U.S. keep that promise? Can they keep rates in positive and maybe even climbing territory if Europe and Japan now have negative interest rates?
And that's the big question, the so-called divergence in central bank policies. So as you point out, the U.S. is in a different place. Back in December, for the first time in almost 10 years, they hiked interest rate by 25 basis points. And they signaled that we will get further hikes, stressing, however, that this will be a very shallow journey. I call it the loosest mm-hmm. tightening mm-hmm. in central bank history. Mm-hmm. That's what they wanted to do. But the problem is that we have a global economy that's very interconnected and very interdependent. So imagine that you're in a car, and one central bank, the most powerful central bank, is tapping on the brakes very gently. Mm. The other systemically important central banks, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China, are pressing on the accelerator. So you have a car where the accelerator is basically pedal to the metal, mm-hmm. and you have someone pretty strong that's tapping on the brakes. That car
does not sound good.
Yeah, and that's exactly what has happened.
Is there evidence that the negative rates now being exercised in Japan and Europe are pumping up growth? Real
there
growth.
There is evidence that they've helped growth. So we have been in a better place than we would have been otherwise. I think that is correct. And we mustn't also forget that the central banks were heroes in 08 and 09 in averting what would have been a multi-year depression, global depression, that would have undermined not just this generation, but future generations. So there is evidence that they've done some good. But we also have to remember that when they went unconventional to pursue economic policies in August 2010, the Fed and Chairman Bernanke said it's all about, quote, benefits, costs, and risks. That's the equation, Tom. Benefits, mm-hmm. costs, and risks. And the longer you stay unconventional, the lower the benefits and the higher the costs and the risk. And at some point, they cross over. And I suspect that we're very close to that point.
You describe what we've all heard you call a T intersection that we're approaching, to keep the car metaphor going, I guess. What's the T intersection, Mohammed?
So the British have this notion of what they call a T junction. And it is an intersection in which the road that you're on ends. That's what you know for sure. Mm-hmm. You can no longer continue on the road you're on.
You've got to go one way or the other, right or left.
You've got to go one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is where we are heading. The road that we're on that has had two very important characteristics. First, on growth. While growth has been low, frustratingly low, it has been stable. And secondly, central banks have been able to repress financial volatility. So even though there's all sorts of things going on in the world, the central banks were able to repress volatility. Why? Because markets believed that they were the BFFs, their best friends forever. Mm-hmm. Now we're seeing both of these characteristics under pressure. The global economy is slowing, and even the healthy parts of the global economy are getting contaminated. And central banks no longer have either the willingness, in the case of the Fed, or the ability, in the case of other central banks, to repress volatility. So the road we're on is going to end, Tom. But there's nothing predestined about how we come out. This depends on choices that our politicians make and that we make.
The choice or the two directions there are really quite different, though. One is sort of hellish. I mean, you say if we don't get our act together, we're looking at potential collapse, all kinds of political. We think we've had polarization so far. Watch out. Things would get really radical and weird. Both economic and political kind of mayhem. The other way is get on top of our challenges and see strong growth. You put political leaders right in the bullseye there and say it's their time, it's their turn. They haven't done it. They have to do it. Are you hopeful about that, watching political campaigns around the country, maybe around the world?
So I'm somewhat hopeful, not totally. Why am I somewhat hopeful? For two reasons. One, this is not an engineering problem. For once, the vast majority of economists agree on the four things we need to unleash growth and to deliver genuine financial stability. It's very unusual to have such agreement among the economists. Yes, they may disagree on which is the most important, but I bet you that the vast majority agree on the four things that are needed. So the first thing that makes me somewhat optimistic is that this is not an engineering problem. This is a political implementation problem. The second thing that makes me somewhat optimistic is that it wouldn't take much from our politicians, because there's a ton of cash on the sideline. You know, we have this very unusual situation where companies have lots and lots of cash on their balance sheets, earning 0% or even negative, as we discussed in Europe. So if they see prospects improving, they can deploy that money in a fashion that supports the economy. And then we have technological change that's happening very quickly. So yes, there's reason to be optimistic, but it's guarded optimism because it's equal probability with a much worse outcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour with big money man and economic guru Mohammed El-Aryan about the state of the world economy. Big decisions right in front of us. Maybe big problems, he says, if we don't choose well. Mohammed El-Aryan is chief economic advisor, strategist at Allianz, one of the world's biggest insurance companies, financial services group. He was CEO at PIMCO, one of the world's biggest bond investors. He's chair of President Obama's Global Development Council and author of the new book, The Only Game in Town, Central Banks, Instability, and Avoiding the Next Collapse. He's with us today from Irvine, California. You can join us as well. Do you see El-Aryan's T-junction ahead? Where we do better or we do a lot worse, depending on the choices, many political choices that we make soon. Do you see how central banks have stepped in where politicians were paralyzed or polarized or ineffective? Are central banks out of ammo now, out of cards to play? Who or what will save us next time? Mohammed El-Aryan there in California. Listen with me. Here's a couple of views of what's going on. This was on CNN yesterday. Investor Jim Rogers at Rogers Holdings with sort of negative view of central bankers and their competence now.
The central banks get themselves deeper and deeper into it. They don't know what they're doing, and it's becoming very clear to most of us. Yes, they're going to keep trying to do everything they can to make markets go higher, but the more they do, the worse the situation gets in.
But here's the biggest central banker, at least in this country, Janet Yellen, Federal Reserve Chair, telling the House Financial Services Committee last week that there are limits to what the Fed can do.
The Fed, of course, has a role to play, but job training, educational programs, programs that address other barriers in the labor market, I think this is Congress's job to address.
Get off your duff, Yellen saying in effect there. And here's Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee talking about that role and kind of agreeing.
When people try to look at the Fed through monetary policy to increase productivity, it's a ridiculous notion, is it not?
Fundamentally, it is
and
not that, something
that's, we that's our control. Job. And we're not doing our job.
That's our job, and we're not doing it, says the Senator. Mohammed El-Aryan, are Yellen and Senator Corker channeling your perspective there?
Absolutely. And now there's growing recognition. Because, Tom, look, what do we need to make sure we can unleash the potential of the global economy and add to our future potential?
Lay it out.
We need four things. The first thing is to have a proper growth model. We as a society invested in the wrong growth model 10 to 15 years ago. We invested in finance as an engine of growth. And there's a reason why finance was called the financial service industry, because it serves the real economy. It cannot be the driver of growth. So what we need to do is, you've heard Chair Yellen, we need to go back to basic issues about investing in infrastructure and in people, about education, about retooling of the labor market, about proper infrastructure, about simple things like reforming our tax system, which is anti-growth. We also have stumbled into such a level of inequality that we have divorced the wallet from the will to spend.
What do you mean by that?
When the bulk of the income goes to the rich, they consume less of it. And when they consume less of it, you end up with a problem of demand overall.
Because you can only buy so many yachts and so much Dom Perignon, I guess.
Yeah. And really the people who need the income are those who consume. So you get a problem there. Third, in Europe and increasingly in the United States, we have a problem of excessive indebtedness. Student loans in this country are going to become a major issue. Not only are they going to cripple a whole generation,
pretty big already,
but they'll discourage people from investing.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, we have no policy coordination. Go back to the image of a car being driven with one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake. That's not good driving. It's not a good way to run the global economy.
A couple of questions. First, on this turn to finance as the heart of the economy, you say 10 or 15 years ago. It seems to me it could go back even a little further than that. Why? How did that happen and why?
I mean, we stumbled into it. We stumbled into it because finance got quite sophisticated. People started believing that finance was the next level of capitalism. You go agriculture, industry, manufacturing, services, and if you're really lucky, you get to financial services. Countries started competing to be the financial centers. If you went big enough, like Switzerland, like Iceland, like Dubai, like Ireland, then you simply exported and you grew your financial sector even bigger than your GDP. And regulators started believing, if it's such a sophisticated system, why do we need to regulate it? Let it go. And next thing we know, we overinvested in finance and we underregulated finance. And then we figured out painfully, unfortunately, in 2007 and 2008, that finance can cause a major accident. And that's what happened.
So how do we get out of that? I think a lot of people have the impression that finance sort of owns our political system now, and they're not lightly going to let major change happen that would threaten their primacy in the economy.
So there's two issues. One is, you can't have a well-functioning economy without well-functioning financial markets. So financial markets can hold the rest of society hostage, and that's exactly what happened. Governments had to bail out banks, and governments continued to support the financial system, but this time it was through the central banks, right? So the central banks still operate through the financial asset channel. So there's a reality that you can't have a good system without functioning financial market. I call it the oil in the car, right? You don't want to really deal with the oil, but without the oil in the car, the car doesn't function. So that's one issue. But the second issue is, we are starting to regulate finance better, but it's a long journey because we don't have the other element that's important, which is the handoff to real engines of growth. So I go back to what you played from the testimony last week. Mm-hmm. They're absolutely right. It's time for the handoff. The handoff from excessive reliance on finance and central banks to a much broader, much more comprehensive policy response.
What would that look like? We'll make you, I don't know, a Speaker of the House or head of the Senate with a majority that will follow you. What would you like to see done in the Congress?
So first, let's invest in infrastructure. With interest rates so low, and in the case of Europe, negative, it's absurd not to be investing in infrastructure that enables and empowers private sector activities. And you can do it directly. You can do it through private-public partnership. Second,
and you're talking roads and airports and all the rest, and that means jobs.
Correct. That means jobs, and it means enabling the private sector. You know, there's a lot of work that's been done that shows that the social return on investment far exceeds these ridiculously low interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
Second, let's reform our tax system. It's one that has evolved over the last few decades through a series of distortions that have been politically motivated and that are anti-growth. We can do that. That's in our hands.
What does that mean? Cutting tax rates? We have the feeling that they're not so high already.
So the cutting tax rate is an issue. But we have ridiculous examples. Let me give you one.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a hedge fund or a private equity firm and you earn what's called carried interest,
sure,
which is an income, you're taxed at the capital gains rate of 15%. That shouldn't happen. That should not mm-hmm. happen. That should be taxed like other income.
But is that more pro-growth, though? I'm sure the hedge fund guys would say, hey, you're going to take more of what we make? That's not pro-growth. That's anti-growth.
But what you do with the money is really important, mm-hmm. right? We have underinvestment in education. We have underinvestment in health. We have underinvestments in lots of things that enable people to produce more. So you have to make choices. But I can tell you, you know, I have a lot of friends in that world. They're not going to change the way they behave if they're taxed properly. They're not going to change. I mean, they say they will, but I don't think they will, right? And then you need to do something about this, what I call the inequality trifecta. It's not just income and wealth inequality. This is becoming an inequality of opportunity. And the minute you start talking about inequality of opportunity, you start being more concerned about our future potential. And the U.S. can play a major leadership role. If Congress unleashes the reform of the IMF and the World Bank, then the U.S. can lead a much more coordinated policy response around the world. There's lots we can do. I go back, Tom, this is not an issue of engineering. This is an issue of political will and political implementation.
So infrastructure, reform the tax system, go at inequality. You say the trifecta. What are the parts of that?
Income inequality, wealth inequality, and the inequality of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So nothing to it. Just have Congress act on that. And yet that's not what has happened. It has been left up to the central bank. Why do you think we've seen this paralysis?
Because we've seen the consequences of low growth. So we are in this vicious cycle. Inaction on the part of our politicians leads to low growth. Low growth leads to frustration. Frustration leads to the emergence of anti-establishment movements, both in the United States and in Europe. What does an anti-establishment movement do? It makes bipartisan much more difficult. If you are a Republican, your main worry as to whether you get reelected every 2 years if you're sitting in the House of Representatives comes from the right of your party. It doesn't come from the mm-hmm. Democrat most mm-hmm. of the time. Mm-hmm. And if you're a Democrat, again, increasingly, the challenge to you comes from the left of your party. So once in office and with an eye to an election in 2 years' time, it's very difficult for traditional parties to come together. And this is not just in the United States. We see it also in Europe. And I go in the book, I go through the 10 underlying tensions and contradictions that are starting to become more apparent as we continue the cycle of low growth, frustrated electorate, dysfunctional politics that feeds back to low growth.
The Only Game in Town is the book by Mohammed El-Aryan. You warn of much stranger politics if we don't get a handle on this, much more extreme politics coming along with potentially a collapse. Describe.
So if we don't get our act together, low growth will give way to recession. If we don't get our act together, high inequality will give its way to even higher inequality. Central banks will no longer be able to repress financial instability, so we'll get financial insecurity. Financial insecurity will lead to economic insecurity. And all that will encourage what I call single-theme political movements. Political movements that come up with very simple themes. Anti-immigration is one example of that. You see it in Europe all over the place. Mm-hmm. And our politics will become more fragmented and dysfunctional, and then it's even harder to get the political response. That's why this book is meant to be a call for action. We have the tools to regain control of our economic destiny. We just have to get the political will.
How close are we to the T junction? I know timing is the hardest thing here, but we've played chicken for a long time. The world you're describing there is one that, I mean, we're in a way, but you're describing much greater instability, in a way, a world that people haven't known for a long, long time. How much time do we have to get our act together?
So like you say, timing is really hard, Tom. In the book, I say within the next 3 years.
That's fast.
It's not an exact science because human behavior is nonlinear. Look how quickly the financial crisis came on us. Very quickly. People were surprised, including very specialist people who observe these things on a high-frequency basis. They were surprised. So these things are difficult to predict because there's an element of human behavior, and human behavior tends to be nonlinear. I also go through in the book, and I say, you know, let's not just wait on our politicians. Let's also ask the question what we can do. And what's really striking, Tom, is that behavioral science suggests that we're not very good at making good decisions when facing a T-junction. It's what the scientists call a bimodal distribution. When you're facing two very extreme outcomes and you end up paralyzed. And that's another thing we have to realize, that we as individuals have to prepare ourselves for this coming T-junction.
By doing what?
Well, first, let's understand how we behave. So there are four behaviors that are typical. One is the blind spot. We just don't see it. We're not used to operate in a T-junction. We assume that the road we're on is going to continue forever. We just don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is we reframe it. We see a T-junction, we understand it, but then when we think about it, we start changing what it really is. You know, I take the example of a married couple having a discussion. You'd be amazed how much reframing goes on mm-hmm. when you're talking. You hear something, but you internalize something else. The third element is what's called active inertia. You realize there's something wrong, but when you come to what you should do differently, you end up doing the same thing. Companies do this all the time. And the really vulgar example, if I may, is the American tourist in France who asks for instructions in English to a French person. The French person either doesn't want to understand or doesn't really understand. What's the American likely to do? Repeat the question in English, but louder, right? So the active part is you go louder, but it's inertia because you're still asking the question.
Doing
in English.
Nothing really effective.
Yeah. So only a small group will end up doing the right thing. But if we understand that that's how we behave when facing bimodal distributions, we can start developing the characteristics that allow us to be in the fourth group and not be hostage to one of the first three.
We'll look at those. Lots of listeners have been waiting to talk to you, though, and I want to begin to go to them before the break here. Ramon in Lexington, Kentucky. You're on with Mohammed Alari in Irvine, California. Ramon.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi.
My business is in Chinese sciences, but I am already working on creating a hedge fund because I believe that what he's saying is exactly right. I disagree as to whether it's an engineering problem or not. I think there are some engineering issues. The top eight banks or derivatives are like $290 billion or $1 trillion or some insane number he can speak to. But I think it's a philosophical issue. But for me, I strongly believe with two major different bubbles in China that the main solution is to take advantage as it's happening. Get through what we call the bamboo node, the difficult spot in between the links, and to actually try and capitalize on some of that money, which would otherwise just poof, disappear.
Wait a minute, Ramon. So you're saying you see Chinese bubbles, you see them blowing up, you want to bet against Chinese economy, and that's your play here? That's your solution?
Not just China. I mean, it's happening in South America. You must realize CDOs did not disappear. And, you know, the 2007-2008 thing, that was mathematical. It may have been human. You know, there was some human element in that they tried to stop it, but there was a mathematical model behind that.
The derivatives. But essentially, Ramon, our time is short before the break, but you're saying it's all going down. Bet against it now, and that's the way to win?
I'm saying that you're talking about a tsunami, and when there's, you know, a couple of ways that you could deal with a tsunami, which is try and get out of the way. But these politicians aren't paying attention, and people are going to get hurt. I think that people have got to realistically look at that the PEs in the Chinese stock market are almost twice that they were in the 99 tech bubble.
Ramon, we've got it. It's a kind of a doomsday view, and there's a way to cash in on it, you say. All right, maybe so. We hope we can do better, but we've got it loud and clear. Mohammed Alari, and please ponder that one. We've got to take a short break, and we'll bring it right back to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back. This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Mohammed El-Arian, and he was CEO of PIMCO, one of the biggest bond sellers in the world. Now he's chief strategist at Allianz. He's chair of President Obama's Global Development Council. Big, big money guy, big economist, thinking big about the world. Says we are hurtling toward a T-junction. We either get beyond the rescue packages of the central banks and get the politicians generating some effective, good, new policy, or we are in big trouble economically and politically. He writes it up in his new book, The Only Game in Town, Central Bank's Instability and Avoiding the Next Collapse. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mohammed El-Arian joins us from Irvine, California today. Lots of callers for you, Mohammed, but you heard the last one, Ramon there calling from Lexington, Kentucky, saying bubbles, bubbles, Chinese bubbles and more. It's going down. It's a tsunami. Bet against it individually and win. That's about as far as we got, but that's a lot. What do you say?
So Ramon makes a very important point that with risk comes opportunity. And I think that that's an important point to make. Now, he's willing to bet on one side of the T, and he seems very confident about it.
It's going down.
It's going down. I think it's still pretty equal probabilities. But he makes a really important point, and it's something that listeners should realize. When you're coming to a T, you need three characteristics. You need resilience in case we take the wrong turn. You need optionality to change your mind as you get more information. And you need agility to be able to act quickly once you have clarity. Now, he believes that the way to do that is by basically shorting everything, starting with China. I think for most people, the way to do this is to make sure you have a bit of cash in your investment portfolio. Don't think of cash as a wasted asset. That's wrong. Okay, it's wrong when you're facing a bimodal distribution. Think of cash as giving you resilience, and you'll be able actually to buy good stocks at very low prices. Why? Because they're going to get contaminated by this volatility. It's what's called contagion, when good names and bad names trade the same because there's too much uncertainty in the system.
What do you think the odds are that it goes down, that it takes Ramon's, you know, sort of descent into hell path?
Look, and this is one of the fair criticisms of the book, and I didn't want to end up there. In fact, one of my friends said if you wanted to sell books, you wouldn't talk about a T-junction. You would just say it's all
going
to go.
It's going down, right.
It's going down.
Here's how to
you'll
save yourself.
A lot more books.
Right.
The last thing you want to be is a wishy-washy economist saying on the one hand, on the other hand.
Right.
But in reality, when you look at the situation, it is pretty similar probabilities. Now, that's bad news because it doesn't sell books when you talk about T-junction. People want something deterministic, but that's the intellectually honest answer.
50-50 scares me. I mean, if that's what it is, that's scary.
Yeah, but importantly, it also says, you know, it's not predestined.
Mm-hmm.
We can change outcomes. And I think that's really important, a really important message to the political class.
What about this guy in the State of the Union speech last month? You're head of his Global Development Council. The president of the United States says anyone claiming the economy's in trouble – it's peddling fiction.
We're in the middle of the longest streak of private sector job creation in history. More than 14 million new jobs, the strongest 2 years of job growth since the 1990s, an unemployment rate cut in half. Our auto industry just had its best year ever.
Hey, happy days are here again. Now, in fairness, the president has a job to do in that speech. I get that. But there he is saying, if you say we're in decline, and many are, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and a whole lot more, all the Republicans, you're peddling fiction. Are you peddling fiction, Mohammed?
So the president is right in saying we've had an amazing labor market. He talks about the 14 million jobs. Look, in the last 2 years alone, we've created 6 million jobs. We stand out internationally as the economy creating the most jobs. And in addition, we're finally seeing wages start to grow at a more robust stage. So if you look at the labor market and you look at the unemployment rate at 5%, you would be encouraged. But there's two issues. One is there's still a lot of people out of the labor force. If you look at the participation rate, if you look at the employment to population rate, they're still at multi-decade lows. So there's a lot more that can be done. And secondly, we haven't unleashed what economists call liftoff, escape velocity, the ability to really grow at this country's potential. So, you know, depending on which side of which part of the glass you look at, on the one hand, we are by far the strongest economy in the world and the ones that have been creating the most job. But the empty part is we could do a lot better if our politicians simply get their act together.
Angela in Austin, Texas. Angela, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Two things. First of all, the gentleman who suggested that he'd like to become a hedge fund manager and buy the opportunity to cash in on China sounds to me a lot like the wealthy men who attempted to monopolize the lifeboats as the Titanic was sinking.
Oh, gosh.
Second of all, the economic situation in which we find ourselves is not the result of 10 or 15 years of financialization, but almost 40 years of financialization. This began in the late 70s or early 80s. And it's clear that what needs to happen is rather than what we did then was release the financial markets, the financial industry from federal regulation, and simultaneously decrease the strength of labor unions. There has got to be a return to union power and worker wages. If companies that are now holding on to large buckets of cash aren't smart enough to release them in the form of employee wage increases, things are not going to get better.
Angela, let me take it straight to Mohammed. Mohammed, what do you say?
So, Angela, thank you on your two points. On the first one, on the hedge funds, I would let you and Ramon have a discussion because that's really between the two of you. On the second one, you have a point. It's been going on for a while. And the nature of humans is sometimes to go too far with a certain thing. So we went too far with the financial sector. We went too far. Like we went too far with home ownership. Like the Chinese have gone too far with stock market ownership. Every once in a while, you come across something that is good up to a certain point. So look at our approach to home ownership. We believe that home ownership was a social good, and it is. But we encourage it too much, and we started creating bubbles. The Chinese believed that encouraging equity market participation by the population is a good thing. Why? You give people a stake in pro-market reforms. And you know what? They've gone too far, and they've created their own bubble.
What about wages and unions in this country? Angela says, you don't fix that, you don't fix anything. That's the way to move the money around.
So the final point that I'd like to take up in Angela is she points to another inequality, which is that the share of profits in GDP have gotten to not just historically high levels, but unsustainable levels. What has been squeezed? Labor. And what happens when you squeeze labor? You get economic problems all over the place. This is just another side of the inequality trifecta, which is that we've embarked on a set of economic policies that have turbocharged other inequality drivers, and now we have too much inequality in too many places in our economy. And the book goes through the cost of that.
Let's go from Texas to Rhode Island. Douglas in Newport. Douglas, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. Appreciate the time. So I think one of the things that economists aren't addressing enough when they talk about this, some do but not all, is that we might be undergoing a fundamental paradigm shift. So I want to throw a small wrench into the system here and say maybe the monetary market system itself is collapsing under the weight of several different things going on at the same time. A massive reduction in the need of human labor to get things done thanks to automation and technical innovations. The reduction of the need for abject scarcity where we have this artificial supply and demand model. So we make up scarcity in order to falsify a demand construct. This is through planned obsolescence or technical efficiencies.
Okay.
And we have a lot of service industry jobs where, yes, we're creating jobs doing what? So fundamental characteristics of 2,000 years plus of operations economically are drastically changing thanks to our own innovations. We are killing the system we created.
Doug, let's pick it up. Mohammed, online here on Facebook, Dick says something similar. He says capitalism is failing. Time to eradicate the plague now.
So Douglas points to something very important that we haven't gotten to, is that our world is being shaken both from above by these macro issues and from below by the sorts of things he talked about. Let me give you a simple example. It took Hilton 100 years to provide its customers with 700,000 rooms. And they built hotels, they managed hotels, etc. It took Airbnb 6 years to supply 1 million rooms. 100 years, 700,000 rooms on the one hand, 1 million rooms in 6 years. And they didn't build a single hotel. What Uber has done to urban transportation, most people are familiar with. We are going through fundamental change, not only technological change, the race with the robot, etc., but also we're starting to use existing assets more productively. The good news is we can lower the cost of services, we can provide more services, and actually we can provide more employment. The bad news is that it has much less of an impact on the economy than when you actually build a new asset.
Yep.
So Douglas is absolutely right in saying it's not just about being shaken from above by macro trends. It's also by being shaken from below by this enabling and this empowerment of the individual to use existing assets more efficiently.
He thinks it's melting down.
Yeah, you know, I'm a worrier by nature, and most people are surprised that I'm not more pessimistic. I also see incredible opportunity in all this. To bet against American entrepreneurial, spirit is a big bet that I would not make. Don't underestimate the ability of people to adjust if only we get clarity on some of the big issues.
And, get benefits that spread around. Tom in Rivers Falls, Minnesota. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Mohammed, real quick, I'll make a couple points and then you can respond. It sounds like you're echoing Nobel Prize economist Joseph Stiglitz or Thomas Piketty or even, dare I say it, Bernie Sanders when you mentioned inequality trifecta with infrastructure spending, higher tax rates are necessary, the college debt bomb. And then one other point, and Tom was even confused by this because of this buzz phrase, pro-growth. Everybody immediately thinks the Republican meme, pro-growth must mean lower tax rates. But you contradicted that and said, no, pro-growth actually means higher rates. Can you comment on that?
Mohammed.
So, Tom, two great points. First, inequality issue. You know what? It's no longer restricted to the left. Donald Trump has been out talking about inequality. I think there's broad-based recognition now that we have gone beyond the point where a little bit of inequality is a good thing. You know, a little bit of inequality encourages hard work. You get rewarded if you work harder, etc. Too much inequality undermines the economy and makes life complicated for everybody. I keep on telling people, you cannot be a good house in a challenged neighborhood.
But look at their plans. You really see Sanders and Trump and Cruz and the rest in the same boat on that? I mean, their plans are very different.
They are. I think there's a basic agreement on the first few steps of dealing with inequality, and then disagreements start to be really big. And where the other Tom is right is saying where they start to be really big is what do you do with tax rates, right? There's two very different views on what do you do with tax rates. One says you cut them. The other one says you increase them on the richest segments of the population. I'm more in favor of the second view because I don't think you get a disincentive of work. But I can tell you that where most people agree is that we have a very distorted tax system. So not tax rate, but tax system that is so distorted, so littered with exemptions that it has become anti-growth. And ironically, both sides of the aisle agree with that.
Are you picking a path through this presidential contender lineup that looks to you like it might head toward the solutions you have in mind? Are you pointing toward Sanders, Trump, Cruz, Clinton?
So let me make a prediction, which is by the time we get to the summer, financial volatility, which has been already high, as you said at the beginning of the show, would have continued. Financial insecurity would have gone up. Economic insecurity will start to increase. And candidates will have no choice but to put forward what their comprehensive plans are, not sound bites, but comprehensive plans. And that's going to give us a much better handle on which of the candidates really understands what's going on and has the urgency to act if and when elected.
You're a smart guy. You're listening already. Where do you think that urgency lies, the right engineering lies among these candidates?
So as I say, it's a question of understanding that you have to move simultaneously on these four steps. And you've got to get Congress. You know, the big historical example comes from the late 50s. America woke up to the news that the Soviet Union, the USSR, what Reagan subsequently called the evil empire, had succeeded in sending up a satellite, and that this was threatening our national security in a way that we hadn't faced before. It was called the Sputnik moment, when our political system woke up to this threat and got its act together. And within a few years, the response was amazing, and it was deterministic. I believe that our political system is capable of having an economic Sputnik moment. And we need just to continue to inform and influence the narrative, because at the end of the day, whether you are a Republican or whether you're a Democrat, right, you really want to avoid the bad turn out of the T-junction.
Who are you supporting for the presidency in 2016?
So right now, I think that the one that has the most coherent position papers on issues that I'm really interested in, which is on the economy, on finance, on regulation, is Secretary Clinton. She has put forward the most comprehensive approaches so far, very serious position papers. I'm waiting to see what the others are going to say. But so far, Hillary Clinton, if it were held today, Hillary Clinton would have my vote today.
Okay. There's a lot more to it than that. It's all in the book. Mohamed El-Arian's latest is The Only Game in Town, Central Banks, Instability, and Avoiding the Next Collapse. This has been really interesting. I hope you'll come back. Let's talk more as this year unfolds. And thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Great pleasure for me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.